I see the importance being in the process of working with someone in the beginning to write a case report such that the case report asks the reader to open up and deepen their awareness both of the analysis, but by definition also of themselves. So one is always asked, what does this mean? Go deeper, be more open. And the process brings to the surface, in my sense, the experience of the analysis in a way that may not have been available in the supervision or perhaps even in one's own analysis. So it deals with residual constraints and inhibitions that then come to the surface, as in the 3-minute chess match, and can be discussed and more openly dealt with, whether in the supervision or in one's own analysis or one's self-analysis. And when the candidate or the graduate analyst has become aware of this and the subjective experiences that have gone on, there's a deeper understanding of the analytic work, both in the case report and, in my sense, in the analytic work where these inhibitions and resistances may also have functioned.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Steven Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. And for 30 years, he's been chairing a discussion group on writing about one's analytic work in a case report, and also chairing a workshop on teaching about analytic case writing, this as part of the American Psychoanalytic Association. And he's recently published a paper entitled The Process of Case Writing, the Fourth Pillar of Analytic Training. Let me correct that. It's a fourth pillar of analytic training. And he discusses what he feels is the difference between a fourth pillar and the fourth pillar. We review the concept of case writing, why it's important. He talks about his mother, who was a poet, and introduced him to the melody of words and also the importance of being heard. We review a number of the inhibitions that we are all familiar with that lead us to put off writing up our cases. And one of them that he mentions that I think is unique to his work, he calls it the re-immersion anxiety, where there's a hesitancy to re-enter the disturbing countertransference world that we all experience at various times in the analyses we conduct. He describes the difference and similarities between being a supervisor and being a writing mentor. He gives case examples of people who edited out aspects of the aliveness that took place with their patients and how by bringing that to their attention, which he feels is uniquely done in case report writing, that he's able to provide them an enduring way for them to change and deepen and listen analytically with more thoughtfulness and more affect in their clinical work. Steve has been writing about writing for a very long time, and one might think that's all he's written about. But in fact, he also wrote early on one of the first articles demonstrating the compatibility of preparatory psychotherapy with subsequent psychoanalysis by the same person. And this at a time when that was frowned upon and not understood. So he has contributed mightily to our field. He's also a delight to speak with, and I hope you enjoy this as I have. Here's my conversation with Dr. Steven Bernstein. Steve, welcome to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you. You have devoted yourself for decades, and literally decades, to the studying and teaching of the importance of writing in the learning and practice of psychoanalysis. And you have mentored many scores of students, candidates, colleagues in their writing journeys, and you yourself have mentors who work with you in your own writing journey. And the kind of writing that you have focused on for this length of time is not theoretical writing, as important as that may be. It's on the clinical case. It's what's happening within the two parties and between the two parties that makes this work so powerful and so enlivening. And you've recently written a paper on that very topic, published in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. And the paper is titled "The Process of Case Writing, a Fourth Pillar of Analytic Training." And we're going to spend some time unpacking that work and your thesis, which is that it, in the process of writing, and especially working with a mentor and supervisor, the person is able to learn some new things about their work, both what they are aware of and things that they are not aware of, and that can enable their work with that patient and subsequent patients to deepen. But before we get to that, I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners a vignette that I've heard you share in your discussion group, which you have been conducting for 30 years. And for people who are familiar with speed chess, they'll know what this refers to. It's when people are asked to do something that's very detailed and can be long-winded, but they're asked to do it very quickly. And there's a truth that emerges in that quickness. And let me turn it over to you to invite you to share that story.
Thank you very much, Harvey. I appreciate the invitation to discuss this with you. It's extremely difficult for people to have taken down hundreds or thousands of pages of process notes on an analysis and to try to find a trajectory, a narrative arc that will allow them to express and write down what has happened in the analysis. The metaphor that I have found useful is the 3-minute chess match, which is basically a timed chess match that chess players often engage in. They may do it for their own purposes. What I suggest is the metaphor of that chess match being done as a way of trying to find the analytic process to force to the surface what one would almost automatically see as what has been happening in the analysis. And so what I do is I ask the writer to tell a colleague or supervisor or myself in some cases about an entire analysis in 3 minutes. And I ask them to repeat this again, and then they tell after 3 minutes, and I say, would you do it again? What comes out can be the beginning of the narrative arc of an analysis, and possibly the more risky and less defended sense of what actually happened, what occurred. So one is asking the person to eventually get to is, what's been going on? What really happened? And in that way, the concept of the 3-minute chess match may make it easier for some people to really, without thinking too much about it or overthinking it, to find a kind of narrative structure to build a case report on.
It's a great example. And I've heard people try to do it, and it really does accomplish that. It really does help people just get to the heart of the matter, which is what your writing has always been about. I want to start us off now with your paper, and I'm going to begin at the beginning and reading the first paragraph and ask for your elaboration. You begin by saying, When we write about our analyses with analytic patients, we write an autobiography like no other. Ours is the most personal, self-exposing, and potentially perilous of all forms of writing. It requires openness, yet it can bring forth a desire to hide in the narrative account in order to remain acceptable to our peers or to ourselves. Some of what we write flows from our emotions, ideas, associations, fantasies, the inchoate and the ineffable. We try to understand our own experience during an analysis and then to convey meaning to our patient and finally to a reader. We tend to our patients and we must also tend to our readers, and yet we may doubt our capacity or worthiness to attend to either. What we write can seem to change with each draft as we try to understand and convey a semblance of reality. Then you go on to say, I am writing about an educational and clinical experience in which impediments to writing arising during the candidate's analytic work are manifest as a lack of motivation to write or as a constraint, distortion, or hiding in the writing of a case report.
The case report has always been seen as a document, as a product. It's been used for teaching, for learning, for research, but also to assess the progress of analytic candidates during training or other people who are looking for advancement in one way or another. So I have really seen the case report in a much different way. It's really not the report that is important in my thinking and my understanding of what one writes about. I see the importance being in the process of working with someone in the beginning to write a case report such that the case report asks the reader to open up and deepen their awareness both of the analysis, but by definition also of themselves. So one is always asked, what does this mean? Go deeper, be more open. And the process brings to the surface, in my sense, the experience of the analysis in a way that may not have been available in the supervision or perhaps even in one's own analysis. So it deals with residual constraints and inhibitions that then come to the surface, as in the three-minute chess match, and can be discussed and more openly dealt with, whether in the supervision or in one's own analysis or one's self-analysis. And when the candidate or the graduate analyst has become aware of this and the subjective experiences that have gone on, there's a deeper understanding of the analytic work, both in the case report and in my sense, in the analytic work where these inhibitions and resistances may also have functioned.
You bring up the issue of supervision, and you discuss that at length in the paper, and I want to start us off by reading just a piece that you've written about that. And you write, I envision the case writing as an activity beginning and developing in the supervision and eventually becoming a separate internalized and independent analytic function of the candidate. The supervision and the writing can act together to stimulate free association and reverie to a new and deeper level. I have not seen any other facilitating mechanism in addition to the candidate's personal analysis, case supervision, and didactic seminars that so profoundly and directly affects a candidate's clinical work. Thus, I am led to propose the process of case report writing as a fourth pillar of analytic training. Tell us more about the fourth and essential pillar, one of the essential pillars, you're saying.
To me, one has to be very careful about adding a pillar to what has been seen as, on the one hand, a fairly rigid group of hierarchically based criteria that people have felt was rigid and constraining. On the other hand, as the frame of psychoanalysis and its education. And so I'm very cautious in not using the term the fourth pillar, but in talking about a fourth pillar, because I feel that we can expand those aspects of analytic training that are essential, and that there may be others. People have cited child observation, infant observation. They've been citing group activities of various sorts as other pillars. And I just think that opening up our thinking, both in theory, but also in the frame of analysis, is a useful kind of thing. And therefore, I take the risk of adding a fourth pillar, tentatively, cautiously, but really, in my sense, with a sense of conviction that it may be an important thing, not so much to make a new definition, but really to highlight the value of the process of writing as opposed to the case report itself.
And you've noted, and we're all familiar, that institutes vary in their understanding, conviction, utility, emphasis on writing in training. Some institutes are very vigorous and have courses in writing, and some not so much. And famously, supervisors do and don't carefully read the case write-ups that are presented to them. And this is a long-standing issue.
But that's very true. But there is one addition I think that's important, namely, in 2000, I think it was 23, the American Psychoanalytic came to the conclusion that case writing was essential as a progression standard for analytic candidates and for graduation, but also for supervisors, such that both candidates and supervisors really have to have knowledge of and experience in case writing. This is a new addition and something that may hopefully stir the kind of expansion of writing that I envision.
And one of the challenges to instituting writing as a central focus in training, including the supervisory case reports, is the tendency, again, speaking for candidates, to not want to do it. I mean, any of us who have been in the educational arm of psychoanalysis are long familiar with it, not to mention within ourselves. And you spend time in your paper discussing what you call the overlapping resistances to the writing. And you've come up with three. And I'm going to ask you to describe the first two, and then we're going to focus on the third, which I think is a more unique contribution. But why don't you mention the first two, and then we'll delve into the third.
If I might, before I do that, I think it might be useful for me to tell the listener how I got to doing this, because it does seem like I am a one-trick pony. And I'm only interested in writing. Obviously, I do much more than think about analytic writing. I have worked and written in other areas. It's just that as a result of seeing the distress of people in their writing and seeing my own distress as not a tremendously accomplished writer in my early beginnings, I really think it's useful to say something about how I got to where I am in the writing. My own journey began, as it does with many people, when I was very young. My mother was a teacher of elocution, which in those days was the teaching of poetry in a very dramatic and expressive and distinct manner with accentuated punctuation. And later on, I have the memories of looking through her canvas-colored suitcase in which she kept copies of the poems she taught to her students and reading them and even later reciting dramatically those poems and listening to her recite the poetry at our large family gatherings and how appreciatively she was received and importantly how she was heard. I think being heard was so important. It was the meaning and the musical expression of the words that I anticipated when later on I went into doing analysis and speaking about it and writing about it. Even though I don't read a lot of poetry or write poetry, I enjoyed the musical theater and acted in high school and college. And I heard others do this and how importantly it was that they felt expressed, able to express themselves and able to be heard. later, and this is maybe somewhat of a tangent, but very meaningful to me, when I was in my teens, I was the drama counselor at a camp for disabled children. And I encouraged the cerebral palsy children to haltingly walk with their wheelchair, pushing the wheelchaired muscular dystrophy children around, knowing that oftentimes the muscular dystrophy children were in a very grave state, but in some way enabling them both to have a voice, to be seen and to express themselves and the joy that they felt. Later on, basically what happened was I was on various committees, able to read people's difficulty writing about their case reports. I had had my own difficulty because early in my training, I was asked to write 6 months of process on a patient and instead submitted process notes, and to my distress was told that it was process notes and that I might want to find out more about how to write about analytic process. So I've been trying to find and help people find the hidden poetry in those words and to find the poetry and the reality in the case reports that they write. So that's really where my journey started and where it is now.
And I want to underline something you said, which is the experience of being heard. For all the years I've known you, Steve, that has always come across as something at your essence. That is, that not only that you wish to be heard, as we all do, but that you're very attuned to others' wish to be heard, both the writer that you're mentoring and also their patient, and your wish to bring alive that encounter in the deepest truth that the two are capable of is a leitmotif of your work. And I hadn't known, A, that your mother was a poet, or B, that you worked in the camp, but it certainly is consistent with who I know you to be. Back to overlapping resistances. It seems a little drier than what you had just presented, but nevertheless valuable. Tell us about the first two, and I will then read about the third.
Basically, I have found in my work recently, in the past, say, 10 years, which is recent in this the history of this writing, three basic inhibitions or resistances to writing, desires to hide in the writing itself. The first two are basically well known, or at least the first is, and it's publication anxiety. It's a fear of criticism or rejection by our colleagues who we want to approve of our work because of our underlying competitive, aggressive, Oedipal fantasies and worries. And candidates have often talked with me about their fear of presenting cases in didactic seminars. And it's interesting that we, who have our own long-term, ongoing, closed study groups, choose to have them in very structured ways that diminish the anxiety through our familiarity and trust built up many years. And they're usually closed, which allows the trust and the carefulness to become manifest over years, so that we have built in to this publication anxiety and the talking about the publication anxiety our own way of inhibiting a fuller aspect of it, or in sometimes obviously also making it more possible. Now, the second of the anxieties is really a transference anxiety, and that's toward the institute that is asking us to write about the case material. It may be based upon our rebellion against submitting to this dominant power of the institute or to one's analyst or supervisor, but basically it's to the institute and a sense that we have of a fear of separating from our dependent position as a trainee and candidate, and some concern about taking on the fuller responsibility of treating patients, as well as separating from our analyst or our supervisor. And it can be associated with fears of success, but it really is, I think, as people have told me over and over again, it's a sense of worried about being lonely and isolated in one's own office without being able to go back and feel in the dependent, cared for role of the candidate. This is an important one because it oftentimes makes people stay in that role too long and not enable them to go out and take their place in the community.
And then you have the third type of resistance that you call reimmersion or countertransference anxiety. And I want to read a paragraph that you wrote about that and then ask you about it. You write, reimmersion or countertransference anxiety and its resultant reimmersion resistance can arise from the desire to avoid reentry into aspects of an intense or distressing past or current countertransference in the analysis. The thought of writing stirs the candidate's desire to avoid unpleasant feelings, fantasies, and associations being reawakened in anticipation of or during the writing. The reimmersion resistance may also be the result of the fear of reanimating a shame-related sense of helplessness and loss of control in a countertransference regression. You go on to say the exposure of one's private thoughts, also possibly experienced as exposing one's private parts, is both wished for and potentially humiliating and may inhibit and constrict self-expression.
This is really the central resistance or inhibition that I have found. And each of these, I think, is a postulate or a proposal of mine, but I think any of our listeners who practice can really wonder to themselves, have I really experienced this in myself? Have I experienced the concern about expressing my thoughts or the sense of being lonely in my office? Or in this way, a desire not to really rethink early experiences of an analysis where the patient's problems were much more overt and may have been in some ways worked through or worked on greatly and become much more tolerable and comfortable as the analysis has progressed. And I want to read an example from one candidate from an analysis long time ago where the supervisee really expressed beautifully a very intense response to what was going on in an analysis. She seemed anxious about re-experiencing and writing about her experience during part of the analysis of a more volatile patient. And she said to me, "The patient feels so cut off from me, as if we were dissociated and speaking from some foreign place. And occasionally I feel the same feeling she describes of being cut off or numb or immobilized. With an inner paralysis, I wondered whether I was dissociating. I was scared, and as I look back, it made me not want to write at all. Even more than that, I don't want to open my notebook and go back into my feelings and relive those helpless and dissociated feelings again."
It's a beautiful example of something that I think may be intuitively understood by supervisors and mentors, but not as clearly expressed as you did in this, the reimmersion anxiety. And that leads to the sense of who we have in our mind when we are writing. And you have a section of the paper that's called No One Writes Alone. And you say, quote, "I believe that the best way to help a candidate write is by working to create a protected, safe, non-shaming, and accepting transitional writing space in which thoughts, feelings, and imagination can freely arise." And you go on to say that case writing requires the writer to oscillate between reverie and the act of writing in order to find a way to tell oneself and the reader about the analytic process. This requires a belief in one's competence and the possibility of being safely heard by the reader. The supervisor or writing mentor is a witness, an intermediary, a way station, a transitional receiver, a substitute for the imagined critical audience, and a midwife to the birth of the writing process. In response to concerns that writers have expressed to me about their fears about what others might think, I have sometimes said, "Write your case report for us. No one else will see it until you are ready and comfortable with it." As supervisors, our verbal and nonverbal attitudes and our conviction and enthusiasm can change the way the writer thinks and feels about the process and the writing. Now, you're describing a really very precious space where one is allowing someone like a clinical encounter, to be trusting and being open. The difference, of course, from the clinical encounter is that the supervisor in those cases is also an evaluator. And share with us how one, obviously one has to honestly recognize that and have that on the table, and how that impacts the two of you.
I think really what you're choosing are really central aspects of the article, Harvey, and I really appreciate it. It gives me a chance to really elaborate some of these points. You know, all relationships have transferences and power dynamics, especially ones that are in educational institutions of any sort. And we need to acknowledge and keep these at the forefront, but in an atmosphere that has rigorous attention to a supervisory frame as opposed to an analytic frame. Just as the analytic situation is always separate, that we are in some way together with and understanding and involved with our patient, but that there is a space, a knowledge that we are at some distance. Also, the supervisory frame has its own kind of parameters. I'm a colleague, but I'm also a teacher, and safety and openness requires rigorous attention to some kind of frame. Now, there are power dynamics that exist in a supervisory relationship, both conscious and unconscious, and on the part of both supervisor and candidate. And I feel strongly, and some people like with different perspectives may differ, but I feel that our relationship is not the central focus of the supervision. The dynamics, only when they become impediments to the analysis or to the writing, should become more central. It's important that I'm describing my own experience as a supervisor or a mentor. I'm not really addressing other people who may have different perspectives, but I do feel that the candidate and I are engaged and involved, but how we respond to each other is not the central focus of the supervision. It keeps us safe and allows me to really create with the supervisee a safe space, a non-shaming safe space where more and more the supervisor and supervisee and I both can bring out our feelings and our thoughts, our associations, our reveries in the service of understanding more and more the analysis and the process.
What you're saying is that unlike an analytic encounter where there isn't that kind of frame where it's in service of learning a particular something, it's much more obviously open-ended and free-spirited, that the purpose of the supervisor relationship is to help someone learn to do the work, to deepen the experience, and in this case of writing, of helping them learn to put pen to paper, as it used to be called. So I think it does explain that when both parties are focused on that task and understand that that's the task, that the issue of evaluation, especially in your good-spirited manner, doesn't become an imposition. And I could easily see that happening, listening to you.
It's even more than that, because any kind of statement I give to the evaluating committee, the progression committee, is really given to the candidate beforehand and discussed with the candidate. In general, I've had the experience of having some wonderful supervisees, many of whom have done quite readily fine work, and where it has not been an issue of any kinds of great concerns. And this really allowing the candidate to see what's written and also discussing it with them obviously makes it quite easy for them to get both positive input, but also at times input that will help them evolve and deepen their work even more.
And that brings us to an example. There are a number of clinical examples in the paper, and I'm going to ask you to read one in a moment. But there's one before that, which really takes up this point. And it's an example where you write that the writing of a recent graduate who had not mentioned several possible erotic transference references in the write-up of an ongoing analysis of a young woman. When I mentioned this to him, he responded with some embarrassment that I had felt some erotic stirrings as a result of my own fantasies, but I thought it was my issue rather than anything coming from the patient. Later, he said that it was useful for him to have discussed his hesitation to write about his fantasies and his need to avoid mentioning these, and said that he was dealing with this in his analysis. It is important to note that without the need to translate the analysis into writing, and this is your key point, without the need to translate the analysis into writing, such insights may not have been accessible to the candidate or the supervisor. And yet, we can assume that the candidate's embarrassment and avoidance of aspects of the erotic transference might have affected the analysis, and they were now available for us to confront and reflect upon together. It's a wonderful example.
This is really the central aspect of the article. It really speaks to what comes out in the writing. And importantly, I've had cases where the supervisee has written an entire case and has left out this kind of material, and in which over a process of rewriting, it becomes more and more clear how central that which was left out is important to the analysis. And I will suggest to the writer that they rewrite the case report from the perspective of what they were worried about revealing in the first case.
That's a great way to say it. Yeah.
And that they would bring out really as a way of demonstrating to themselves and perhaps to any committee reading this, demonstrate their capacity for openness, for deepening the work, and importantly, for self-supervision, which is the sine qua non of the independent analysis and analyst, the ability to really work on one's own, perhaps with consultation, etc., but to be able to work on one's own, and that requires self-supervision. And therefore, the trust in both the supervisor, but also in those outside readers, is very, very important, because what it says is, if I can trust the outside reader, perhaps I can trust myself. And I think it's trusting oneself with one's underlying fantasies, associations, and concerns and impediments, which then become lessened as a result of the process, that we become more able to self-supervise and use our self-analysis to really further our work.
And let me invite you to read somewhat abbreviated from the paper, but nevertheless, careful explanation and demonstration of how this worked with a fictional Dr. S.
This is really an illustration of the work that I've done with many supervisees and writers about working with a process where there is a problem. This is not just an easy way of thinking about what's going on and how it can be lightly dealt with, but how the writing becomes part of the experience of the reader, and how through supervision or mentoring, one can help the writer get on a path to re-examining, being more open, and changing both the writing and the underlying analytic clinical work. So this is an example of a longer illustration that I wrote, but this, I think, encapsulates really what I've been talking about. I'd been working with Dr. S during a long and deepening analysis, now in the fifth year and perhaps toward termination. She and I were quite open about sharing our associations and fantasies about the analysis with each other in response to the patient's growing openness. She decided to write about the case, and I suggested that she write about 4 pages from an earlier time and eventually bring it back to our discussions. Several weeks later, Dr. S sent me some pages. I was quite surprised by what Dr. S sent. Her writing about the early phase was affectless, flat, distant, leaden. It reflected her earlier feelings years before, as if she were there now. Then she would tell me how her patient's silences and grudging utterances made her feel bored and angry. She seemed to have retreated to the earlier stage of our work. things had changed and I had hoped her writing would reflect the now as opposed to the then. Was she reenacting her shutout experience by reenacting me in the writing? In the writing, she referred to the patient and the analyst. She generalized and summarized about what she and the patient said. She used the passive voice throughout. Her resistance was interpreted rather than I said. And she showed little about how she was affected in the process. As I read on, I had a vision of being blocked behind a high brick wall, unable to see where I was going. Had I failed in helping Dr. S. to maintain the gains in her work that I had seen? Was the wall in the writing a way to deal with the feelings about her patient's earlier intense anger at her husband or some anger at me? I saw my edits as trying to pull Dr. S. back from her retreat. When I mentioned my sense of feeling a bit walled off in the writing when we met, she responded by saying that I remember my patient's white-hot anger at that time. It scared me. I felt scared and lonely. I remembered how, having felt her helplessness and my own experience of the wall she had experienced, it was a unique but not uncommon moment in which memory and metaphor came together. But it was a deepening in our mutual experience. As we spoke about the writing more over several weeks, Dr. S. seemed less entrapped by her feelings from the past, and I saw the writing change and become more open. Through several drafts, I was hoping to decrease Dr. S.'s residual constraint that had reemerged under the stress of revisiting the early analysis, a retreat that had brought to the surface all the feelings in the writing. And with each rewriting, her writing became more self-revealing and freer. After one particularly open discussion, Dr. S. said, "Sometimes I feel that the writing and my ability to use my imagination during the analysis seem to have gone together. Perhaps this was said to please me. But sometimes when a supervisee and I work together for an hour, sharing reveries in a place without walls, it seems believable."
Believable indeed, even to the listener. It certainly seems believable. It's a wonderful example, again, of that concept that you've come up with, the re-immersion anxiety, where she was so hesitant to go back to that place. And again, I don't think that's been written about until you have. I want to conclude, Steve, with reading the last paragraph from your paper. You write, "If the process of case writing, begun and edited through with a supervisor or writing mentor, can highlight and help diminish the candidate's intrapsychic and intersubjective impediments, and if these have influenced the writing and the analytic functioning of the candidate, then what has occurred is quite profound and potentially enduring. As the writing and the analysis deepen, the case writing and its corresponding self-reflection may become less and less a part of the supervisory relationship, and instead a separate, more independent, and internalized analytic function of the candidate. It is on the basis of the resultant ability of the candidate to more profoundly do the conscious and unconscious work of analysis that I propose that the process of case writing is a fourth pillar of analytic training." Really beautifully said, and I want to share with you something that I have not. And it's that I was in a meeting unrelated to anything we're talking about and with people who don't know you. And the topic of case writing came up. And someone chimed in the discussion and said, "If you want to do anything with case writing, you have to read Bernstein." And that's it's a wonderful legacy among many that you've left many of your supervisees and your mentees and your colleagues with whom you have worked over the years. And I know many of them, and I have been part of that group that has been among them. And I can speak for us by saying we are grateful for your leadership in this area. And that the American Psychoanalytic has now included case writing as one of its, dare say, pillars. That I think your work and your 30-year discussion group is certainly an important part of that moving forward.
I would like to thank you, Harvey, for in some way helping me continue on my journey and also helping me deal with my own inhibitions and resistances to describing this openly with you. And I do feel that you're a wonderful interviewer. I've told you this before, but I do feel that it adds something very important with all the areas of discussion you have. And I do thank you for this opportunity.
Been my pleasure. Thanks so much. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.